Welcome to the History of Little Europe, Episode 1.5, How to Conquer Germany. So, it's been a while. I believe the last I uploaded was October. During that time, I was not, in fact, sitting around doing nothing. I have been working on the podcast. I just haven't had much time. Like everyone else, however, I now find myself stuck inside with little else to do. So expect much more content from the podcast in the next few weeks. Since it's been a while for all of us, last time, we left off with the death of both Charles Martel and with him the last pretenses of Merovingian rule in Francia. Immediately following his death, his sons decided to partake of the time-honored tradition of fraternal conflict, with the upshot being that Pepin the Short, the older of the sons, became mayor of the palace and de facto king. He would also be the last person for which I need to make that distinction, as in 752, a letter from the Pope provided the necessary justification to have Childeric III, the last of the Merovingians, deposed. In short order, a council of Frankish nobles was called, who unanimously elected Pepin the Short the new king, officially beginning a new Frankish dynasty. No doubt the presence of Pepin's entire army smoothed the voting process, but there weren't any real challengers anyway. The departure of Childeric also means that we are finally done with the Merovingians, and can now transition into the Carolingian dynasty, which is good, at least for the fact that we can be done with the confusing names. It also means we'll start to see some actual Swiss history beginning to appear on the horizon. Because we've been taking a rather lengthy detour to cover all material relevant to our destination. As an aside, my goal with all of this is to be able to jump into entirely Swiss history by the 12th century, with no background or context needed. In addition, if I ever wanted to do a history of any of the Benelux countries, this material will provide a good jumping-off point. Pepin the Short was an intensely pious man, as can easily be gleaned from the constant wars he waged on nearly every border of the empire. Joking aside, Pepin could be considered the most important figure to Christianity that nobody ever talks about in Christian history. You have to remember that during his lifetime, the Muslim Moors still controlled all of Spain and Portugal, Italy, Rome, and the Pope were under the control of the Lombards, descendants of barbarian raiders, and Germany was still mostly made up of pagan tribes. Comparing that to the typical picture we have of the dominance of Catholicism from Gibraltar to the Mongols in medieval Europe, it is clear that there must have been a great change, and Pepin is a key role in bridging these two periods of religion in Europe. His first major action was to declare war on the Lombards, who had continued to make incursions against both the Byzantines and the Pope. After successfully defeating their forces, Pepin made his great donation to God by giving a band of territory across the Italian peninsula, including Rome, to the personal property of the Pope. Later known as the Donation of Pepin, this would begin the thousand-year life of the Papal States, and effectively ensure that Italy would not unite as a single nation until 1870. It would also solidify the strong relationship between the popes and the Carolingians, which will be very important in about 5 minutes. Next, he would continue the work of his father by campaigning against the Caliphate, forcing the Moors firmly out of the Pyrenees, and after a fairly bloody scorched-earth campaign, he managed to finally conquer Aquitaine, bringing Bordeaux and Toulouse into the Frankish fold. All of this would also begin to set in motion the second of Pepin's great contributions to the Catholic Church, the beginning of the Reconquista. Unfortunately for Pepin's legacy, these two campaigns, along with continuing the endless skirmishing against the Germans, would make up the entirety of his reign. Pepin reigned for 17 years, but he was neither as honored as Charles Martel nor as crucial to history as Charlemagne. Laying him to rest, it is at last time to come to somebody deeply intertwined with the fate of Western Europe, and the person who would lay the foundations of a new era. We arrive, at last, at Charlemagne. Charles the Great, or Charlemagne, as the butchered pronunciation prefers, is a figure well beyond the scope of this podcast, and someone I can guarantee I will not dedicate enough time to, because no matter how much there is to discuss, we'll have to be done with him by the end of this episode. In almost every way, he seems to have been chosen at birth to outshine everything his father ever did, banishing him to appendices in a few brief minutes of this podcast. At the age of 15, Charles took up the mantle as the defender of Catholicism by swearing an oath of allegiance to the Catholic Church, which would, as his reign progressed, switch between either divine justification or downright ironic. Upon his father's death in 768, the kingdom was split between him and his brother, Carloman I, with Charlemagne receiving the wealthier areas of France and his brother receiving the poorer interior. Seemingly unwilling or unable to learn the lesson of every man who came before him, Pepin had designed the inheritance to be a power-sharing agreement, but but as had always happened before, a period of civil war would continue between the brothers until one controlled the whole kingdom. It took all of half a year before they were at each other's necks. The catalyst, in this case, turned out to be Aquitaine, which their father had spent nearly a decade brutally subjugating, and which now rose up in revolt. The territory fell exactly between the two brothers' boundaries, and seeing the opportunity, Charles rushed to subjugate the rebels and annex the territory. Seeking to press the advantage and consolidate control, Charles then married a Lombard prince named Desiderata, seeking to gain an ally in the Italian kingdom and surround his brother with enemies. Unfortunately for him, the marriage proved so unhappy that within a year he had the marriage repudiated, sending the Lombard king Desiderius into a rage. If he had been any other man, Carloman would have used this new ally forged by his brother's political miscalculation to press the advantage, but after spending several months weighing his options, the universe had had enough of him and killed him off. The stated reason of death, while unconfirmed, is a nosebleed. With the entire kingdom consolidated in relatively short order, Charlemagne I had to deal with the Lombard king Desiderius, who, after finding a more powerful enemy to the north, decided to turn his anger elsewhere. Conveniently for him, the Papal States were just nearby, relatively weak, and strong allies to the Carolingians after Pippin had donated the kingdom to them. He immediately began waging a campaign against the Papal States, which managed to go well for him, right up until Charlemagne found out and invaded Italy. Within 2 years, he had successfully conquered all territory as far south as Rome and as far west as Venice, expanding his kingdom beyond the Alps and ensuring the existence of the Pope's dominions. This also included a section of the Alps which, in time, would become part of Swiss territory. Charlemagne decided to consolidate this region by having one of his sons made King of Italy and another, named Louis, as King of Aquitaine. Following this, he turned his attention to the eastern border, and specifically to the Saxons, who he would attempt to subjugate. This particular conflict ended up being the most drawn out of his entire life, and over several decades, the Saxons would prove to be a continued source of rebellion and strife. The war with the Saxons also marks Charlemagne's first war with an expressed purpose of dealing with the paganism found in the area, which helped to ensure the conflict would not be ended quickly. The final solution came in 804, when he decided to take 10,000 Saxons and switch them with 10,000 Christians living in Neustria, and allowing the two groups of Saxons, now each a minority, to be slowly integrated. This conquest aggravated the Scandinavian kings, unhappy with the new neighbor on the southern border. But this matters less for Charlemagne as his successors, so we will ignore it for now. Charlemagne would spend the next years subjugating various tribes along the border, including the Bavarians, the Slavs, and the Carthaginians, who are located in modern-day Austria. The big prize for Charlemagne in his conquest of eastern tribes was the Avars, who were a wealthy tribe located in what is today Slovakia and Hungary. In 788, the Avars invaded Bavaria. Charlemagne was preoccupied with other matters until 790, when he marched down the Danube, simultaneously ordering a Lombard army under his son Pepin to march north and meet him there. At this point, it is worth mentioning that Charlemagne's army was able to conquer so effectively by using a strategy of prolonged conflict comparable to guerrilla warfare or Fabian tactics. His army was somewhat notorious for actually being quite bad in large battles, and were most effective over long campaigns. This was achieved in tandem with aid from his vast empire and more advanced logistical support for his army, which in time allowed him to wear down opposing nations. Now, this particular campaign lasted until the Saxons revolted again, which took his attention away from the campaign. For several years, Charlemagne struggled to wage a campaign against the Avars for long enough to subjugate them without being distracted, but eventually the Avars were thoroughly defeated in 803. Facing additional pressure from the Bulgarians on their respective eastern border. This conquest would not be Charlemagne's last, but it would prove to be the furthest east he conquered, as well as the last to successfully integrate new wealth and territory. Charlemagne attempted to secure all of these new gains with a new system of administration. He divided the empire into two main regions, the inner core, comprising most of modern France, and the outer regna, which contained all other territories in Germany, Italy, and beyond. The inner core was ruled directly by Charlemagne, while the outer regna was divided into counties, which were ruled over by counts. They, in turn, ruled over several lesser nobles who were more connected with the actual territory. Some territories were also organized into duchies, which were made up of slightly more distinct populations. Now, all of this served him well within his own lifetime, as it allowed him to focus on the general trajectory of the kingdom while the borders were kept in check. But it also laid the foundations of the future collapse of the empire. In the west was a single unified France, while to the east was a more chaotic mix of smaller territories comprising Germany. In time, this difference would help to forge the Holy Roman Empire into the chaotic body of thousands of tiny states that it is best known as. It would also allow new, smaller kingdoms to form, including several that, in time, would become the foundations of Switzerland. The most well-known event of Charlemagne's life, though, was a symbolic one. In 799, Pope Leo III fled from Rome, being persecuted by enemies within the papacy. Charlemagne, wanting to ensure his position within the Catholic Church was upheld, marched on Rome, essentially forcing everyone at gunpoint to accept Pope Leo's innocence. This left the Pope in a rather inconvenient position, because it suggested that there was now precedent for a king to name who the Pope was, making his position a mere vassal of the most powerful nation. Thus seeking to reclaim some authority of his own, on Christmas Day, the Pope surprised Charlemagne at Mass and proclaimed him Holy Roman Emperor. This title, while later bearing almost no connection to the Roman Empire, originally did mean that Charlemagne held the same title that Augustus had held many centuries previously. Now, there has always been debate as to how much Charlemagne compelled the Pope to go through with this, and it is certain that Charlemagne at least knew it would happen prior to the coronation. But there is reasonable evidence to suggest that the whole event was orchestrated for his own gain. He was, at the time, growing increasingly belligerent with the Byzantines as he attempted to seize Venice, and claiming such a title would give him a claim to essentially any territory held by them. But it also created a new relationship with the papacy. The emperor had precedent to name the pope, but the pope had precedent to name the emperor. This circular sharing of power would undermine the relationship between the two that had been built up by Pepin the Short, and would be a source of conflict for centuries to come. Charlemagne would spend the rest of his lifetime consolidating the empire. He would standardize the currency, establishing the silver livre and a series of strict denominations that ended the hundreds of different systems present across the empire. He also instituted stricter rules for recording income, which helped cut back on corruption and increase tax revenue. He standardized the written script, which in time created the lowercase letters used today. He intervened heavily in the church, focusing on strengthening the church's power structure, improving moral quality, and standardizing liturgical practices. And seeing the need, he strengthened educational institutions throughout the empire. It is thanks to his efforts in this regard that a great number of texts from the classical era survived at all. All of these things combined to kick off what has become known as the Carolingian Renaissance, a period of great advances in scholarship and literature not seen since the fall of the Roman Empire, nor matched until the Italian Renaissance several centuries later. With all of Western Europe now more politically, culturally, and economically unified than it had been in centuries, he died in 813, lamenting on his deathbed how many projects he still left unfinished. As always, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, declarations, manifestos, or affidavits, feel free to send them to historyoflittleeurope@gmail.com. Stay tuned, and be sure to subscribe and give the show a 5-star rating. Until then, pozdrav, ciao, and goodbye.